In a final effort to break through the barriers, I shouted into the deepening blue above me for help, clinging desperately to my mantra, but I found myself yet again descending back to earth, lonely and dejected. Confronted with the unending cycle of rising and falling and conceding the limitations of my power, all I could do in the end was to surrender and let go of my ambition and desires. I drifted down to earth like a leaf from its branch, until finally I landed softly on the ground. It was a forest floor. I rose to my feet and started walking to find out where I was and perhaps a way out of it. I came to a clearing, and instinct told me to stop. I found myself staring at a space about 10 feet in front of me. 80 Suddenly, out of midair, four strange red objects appeared. I couldn't identify what they were at first. Absurdly enough, the thought occurred that they could be socks, until I saw them taking the shape of Chinese silk or paper lanterns, forming a perfect rectangle. This strange spectacle had a magical effect on me, and I stared at the square with fascination. There was a presence about this which prevented me from withdrawing my attention, and for some time I just stood and stared in curiosity, wondering what sort of magic was going to take place. Suddenly I knew this was going to be a very special event. I was about to meet a great person, an ancient master and a wise man. Although I couldn't see him, he was already there, announcing his arrival invisibly. I could feel a powerful presence. My heart started beating faster, and with a strange mixture of joy, dread and expectation I stared into the center of the magical square. The lanterns dissolved into the air, and in their place I observed the gradual appearance of an enigmatic figure, not standing as one might, but propped casually on his elbow in a half-sitting position with his hands folded over his stomach, one knee bent and the other leg outstretched. He wore a modest gown, but his face showed a character and charisma I have rarely seen before. It was lined by a habitual expression of humor and good-naturedness. He was Chinese in origin and beamed at me cheerfully, totally at ease. I recognized him. I had known him all my life, no, for all eternity. I felt the thrill of a long-wished-for reunion. Finally, after years of struggle, searching for assistance with my yoga practice, he had come to answer my call. I was overwhelmed, humbled and honored at the same time. I threw myself in front of the great being and touched his feet. The Chinese master laughed and kicked me gently. Can you imagine how ridiculous you would look if someone strolled past and saw you touching my feet? He was an old friend. When he spoke to me, his words were full of enlightened humor and wonderful gentleness. I can't remember all of what he said, but each word had a powerful effect on me, reaching right into the core of my being. 81 While I was kneeling in front of him, he kicked me gently with his bare foot every time he wanted to emphasize a point. Gradually, his kicks assumed a more regular circular movement on my chest. They turned into a rhythmic massage around my heart. Every time I felt the pressure, my heart burned as if a fire had been lit. His movements were fanning the flames until I could hardly bear it. The fire spread through my whole body. I was consumed by a strange combination of pleasure and pain. Then, unexpectedly, out of the corner of my eye I saw Julia approaching us. My attention to what he was saying slipped momentarily. Julia spoke to me, but I was trying to re-grasp what the master was saying, so I apologized and asked him to repeat what he had just told me. He winked at me and laughed. You are easily distracted by a beautiful woman and equally easily lost within yourself, so that you miss all the good things. I knew he was right. Lack of attention was one of my greatest challenges. I felt embarrassed. He spoke again, but what he said is difficult to put into words. He sent me images like riddles, and I understood the symbolic meaning instantly, realizing that words could never contain the wealth of information that these symbols could. One image he sent me, with a broad smile, contained three pieces of cake. It's a piece of cake, I heard him think jokingly. One piece was whole, the second was almost cut, and the third was cut into two pieces. At the same time he sent me an image of Christmas and awakened in me the memory of an almost childlike expectation of Christmas. I understood that the three pieces of cake represented three events. The whole piece of cake represented the anticipation of a great event, the second piece the experience of a great event, and the cut piece the passing of the event. Which of these events would require your greatest attention? He asked with a smile. After a little hesitation, I pointed to the piece of cake which was cut in half and answered, "If I treat all events as if they have already passed, then I will never get attached to them and will always be free." My master nodded and chuckled and then closed his eyes as if lost in deep thought. 82. The burning lasted for more than 2 weeks. Whenever I thought back to that meeting, it flared up as if somebody had set fire to my heart. At the same time, I was consumed with an ecstatic joy which would last for hours each time. Next headline, Pointers from Another Dimension. 29th of September 1977. After 2 months, I met my Chinese master again. He greeted me with a broad grin and told me that he had another test for me, and he showed me to a door in an open field. He said this test was very important, because everything in life depends on it and that there was only one way to get through the door. With that, I was bombarded with a stream of images and symbols which I simply cannot put into words. It felt as if the symbols were part of a very compact language which was rooted in a higher dimension, too sublime and too complex to be translated into human language, and yet it felt as natural to me as everyday words. I passed through the door several times. Each time it would open inly when I had adopted the right attitude. I felt our reunion had come to an end. I felt like I had been with a friend, an equal, someone who would not dream of assuming a superior role, someone of such modesty and absence of ego that the whole universe rushed in to fill the space. His presence was not that of a man but the presence of infinity itself. This was the greatest lesson I took from our meeting. I looked at him again, one last time. He had not changed his position for one moment. With his eyes closed, he appeared to be in deep meditation, maybe even sleep. The thought amused me. For a second I remembered him as the old friend he once was, and in light banter I shouted, "Hey, you look almost dead." My friend opened his eyes and laughed out loud. "Get away," he yelled, and we both laughed. "I'll be seeing you." With this I rushed back into my body. When I opened my eyes, I was slumped forward with a burning feeling in my chest. Next headline, The Elusive Master, 6th of September 1977. I became lucid almost as soon as I fell asleep. I used the focusing on the ground technique to achieve full waking consciousness. Julia was with me. I was excited and attempted to help her achieve lucidity too, so that we could share our experience together and compare notes upon waking up. I talked her through the process of gaining lucidity by asking her to let the soil run through her fingers, to feel the sensation, to watch the little crystals and to hear the sound, but she didn't seem interested and disappeared. A moment later I looked around and found myself in a vast, long unearthly landscape, a huge valley surrounded by a massive mountain range. There was a mist everywhere, not like cloud but sparkling like opal. This had a strange effect on my feelings. I couldn't figure out whether the mist was a result of my surroundings or of my emotions. I was mixed up intimately with my environment and it felt great. I was overwhelmed by a feeling of intense love which lifted me into the air, and the higher I rose the more intense the feeling became. It came in waves and the only way of dealing with it was by allowing it to pass straight through me. The effect was that I lit up like a giant light bulb, illuminating my surroundings. I felt utter bliss. I cannot remember how long I remained in this state, but I had a desire to contact the Chinese master again, more out of curiosity than of need. I focused my attention on the master while chanting the mantra, and with it I was swept off the ground and catapulted through the air. But the movement was inconsistent. The feeling of joy wasn't there any longer. I had to use the power of my mind to maintain movement. The environment started to change. Before long I looked down onto black and choppy ocean waters beneath me. Some waves rose frighteningly into the air, higher and higher. I cannot tell how long my lesson lasted, but I was told that I had passed another important test, which would enable me reach much further. But there were no goodbyes this time. My Chinese friend just vanished. Next headline, final tests. 8th of March 1980. On the same morning I had visited myself in the life of the petty tyrant, I lay in my bed with my eyes closed, still highly sensitized to the next dimension. Even when I opened them I knew I could slip back into lucidity easily and leave my body. I still had the familiar sense of dual, greater than awareness, which would allow me to transport myself to any part of the universe on another dimension with an active will. I felt confident alarmingly. I lost altitude and was soon surrounded by mountainous waves on all sides. I darted in and out, avoiding the water mountains, trying desperately to gain altitude, but the more anxious I became the more I lost control until I plunged right into the sea. Fearing that I was about to drown I cried out for help. This was not a dream, but reality. I could feel the cold and the fear of doom. In a desperate effort I tried to gather my reasoning power to remind myself that I was in control, but the reality of the raging ocean around me made a mockery of the notion that I was in charge. I was tossed around violently, overwhelmed by titanic forces that rendered me utterly helpless. With a last mighty effort, and with the desperation of a drowning man, I cried for help from my master. Suddenly, as if from nowhere, a ring was thrown over me and I was pulled towards a platform. On this pontoon stood a man, pulling me closer. I thought I recognized my Chinese friend, but as I got closer I noticed that it was not the master I had hoped for at all. He was my old religious instruction teacher from school. "You wanted a master," he said as I climbed onto the raft. "I am your master." He laughed out loud. I never liked this teacher and I was deeply disappointed. I made a strong effort of will until I opened my physical eyes in my bed. I felt hurt, if not angry, lying in my bed with my eyes wide open. Then I saw the funny side. I had been teased because I had cried for help like a child, and what a great cruel joke and a splendid lesson it was. Courage was needed to conquer these worlds. It was typical of my Chinese friend to mock me and ridicule my weakness. Finally, I plunged myself fully into the second state of awareness. This time I wanted to protect myself against the very real possibility of being drawn back into the life of the petty tyrant. I decided to call for protection and so I focused on my Chinese friend and master. No sooner had I conjured up his image than was I catapulted into a strange room. Nothing was happening, but I knew I was about to be tested. There was an element of occasion about this, as if my life was at stake, like a test of life and death. "Everything you have done so far has been a dawdle," I was given to understand via a disembodied voice in my head, which I recognized as that of my master. "But if you want to go further, you'll need courage and lots of it. Unfortunately, you just act like a little child." I was bewildered. "This is not necessarily a bad thing," he continued. "You can use your childishness to your advantage." I could sense his amusement and the familiar giggle, but I still could not see him. It didn't stop him from lecturing me. I was told that fear was a great obstacle in my quest and had no place in my life, neither on this level or any other. "To rid yourself of your fear, guilt and all those images that are haunting you from your past, you will have to go back to the same state of mind you had when you were a baby. Babies don't have any fear because they don't carry any images around from the past and they don't have an idea of the future." I was made to understand that the only way to rid myself of fear, guilt and all the past life images that were haunting me was to appeal to my childishness or, better, to a childlike innocence. I became aware that the room was a very dangerous place. So dangerous in fact that I had to get out at all cost. Remaining there would have meant a fate worse than I could imagine. The sum total of all my past life deeds and suffering would brew together and obliterate me. The room had one exit, but the frame of the doorway was punctuated with dozens of holes. Out of each hole a sharp spearhead ifa protruded, easing slowly in and out in a random manner as preparing to strike anyone trying to escape the room. This is brilliant, I thought. Cannot stay and I cannot get out. I knew quite clearly that I had a third option. I could simply wake up, get out of bed, have a cup of tea and pretend it was all a dream. But I knew equally that this was not an option at all. What would happen here would have an effect on my whole evolutional progress. If you do not pass this test, it is virtually pointless to carry on venturing into the next worlds. It will simply bore you out of your head to do so. There is nothing more to be gained. As I pondered my options, it became clear to me that there were only two ways of getting through the doorway. I remembered what it was like to be a child with no fear of death, with the absolute knowledge that I would be safe because I couldn't even conceive of the danger. The second way was courage. The courage and fearlessness of a powerful warrior who was not afraid to die and could not conceive of any enemy that could not be defeated, no matter how powerful he was. As I stared at the doorway, trying to conjure up innocence or heroism, I saw to my great surprise and amusement four people out of nowhere strolling past me and straight through the door. It was such a stark contrast to my trepidation that I burst out laughing. "They don't know of any danger. But you do," the voice whispered cheerfully into my ear. "Ignorance is bliss." I pinned my eyes at the spears in the doorway, which were still easing in and out, set to impale their victims. I was back contemplating my two options. I remembered my early childhood, sitting on my mother's lap and being told the fairy tale of the Wicked Witch and how she locked Hansel and Gretel into a cage while she prepared to eat them. I remembered saying to my mother that they hadn't done anything wrong, so surely the witch could not harm them, and my mother telling me that I was right. "If you are innocent and you put your faith and trust into whatever you do, you cannot be harmed by anyone." Having just escaped from my wretched life as a petty tyrant, I was about as innocent as a naughty child caught with his hand in the cookie jar. Going through the door would have meant certain death. I pondered the consequences and I wondered whether if I failed I would die physically, perhaps suffering a heart attack. I didn't have a clue as to the outcome. Silence answered. Then in a stroke I realized that I was already dead. Or more accurately, there was no death. There was no fear. I simply walked through the door, fearing nothing. No heroism was involved, no courage, just realization. I passed through the door unharmed and entered a beautiful garden. In the center I found a huge magnolia tree. As I looked up, a large blossom tumbled down and landed softly in my cupped hands. I looked at the petals affectionately as they surrendered in my palms. I had passed the test. I looked up at the magnolia tree and there at the top hung the most glorious blooms I had ever seen. I made an effort to rise from the ground into the air to pick the flower. It was hard work and took several attempts and a number of elaborate stunts and complicated acrobatics to claw my way to the top. When I got there, I saw that the same blossom I endeavored to pick was already nestling in my hand. I felt foolish at having fallen for the illusion. Next headline, the great dimensional subdivisions. After many years of leaving my body and investigating alternate realities, I feel tempted to draw a summary and paint a reasonably comprehensive image of what life will be like when we disassociate ourselves finally from the dense vibrations that form our physical dimension. In some ways, this may differ from the accounts given by mediums and psychics, firstly because these are first-hand accounts and secondly because they are not addressed to those bereaved. Consequently, I see myself more as a reporter than as a counselor, a researcher rather than a transmitter of other people's views or spirit observations. The fact that I have been there myself to see it and hear it may fill in any gaps in knowledge mediums may have brought across with them. I am confident, in fact, that science has come to the conclusion that physical life in the universe simply can't exist without other dimensions underpinning its existence. Unfortunately, I am not a scientist. If I was, my viewpoint would have been conditioned rather differently than by my work as an artist. The conclusions I draw are, obviously, subjective, and future observers may differ in their own. Surprisingly, it has taken science quite a long time to realize that we are part of a multiple universe. It is the same paradigm shift for our perception as the discoveries of fire, the wheel, and that the Earth is a sphere and evolves around the Sun. Incredibly, psychology and the science of the mind still need to catch up and move beyond looking at consciousness as a function of biological and chemical events within the brain. What we will have to acknowledge is the fact that the universe outside not only has its origin in other dimensions, but that we as living organisms are at every moment operating in other dimensions without realizing it, here and now. In fact, to imagine that we could function as purely physical dimensional entities strikes me as absurd, because it would be akin to imagining that the Earth could exist without the space it is suspended in. Incredibly, we still believe that the brain is the main storage organ for everything we experience. Considering the fact that every moment, every split second, we encounter trillions of bits of information via our vision alone, it is clear that scientists still have no idea as to where or how the data is stored. All we know is that the brain's synapses process the data. By studying the brain from a biological viewpoint, we may understand its function but not its deeper mystery. When looking at it from the next dimension up, the brain is a fantastic relay station, a processing and communication plant between two dimensions. The information appears to be stored on another dimension altogether in a state that simply cannot be attributed to molecules or physical atoms. This doesn't apply only to the information gathered in our present time-space continuum, but also to information gathered while living in different energy configurations such as previous lives and interlives. First, we will have to accept that life in the next dimension will be different for everyone, the same as it is here, so to give a comprehensive description of life over there is impossible. Every afterlife will be different. The best way of describing it is by drawing a parallel of three visitors from outer space landing on Earth and having to report back of what they find. One lands in the desert, the other one in the middle of Venice, and the third underwater in the Great Barrier Reef. Obviously, each one of them would give an accurate yet totally different account. Even if they had all landed in the same place, their accounts would still deviate because they would focus on different attributes in accordance with their viewpoints and personalities. What can be said is that people vibrating on a higher energy level will be living more enjoyable and satisfying lives than those on a lower one. By higher, I mean energies which are not centered around selfish instincts to the exclusion of others. Psychologists of the future will work more effectively once they acknowledge that there are hierarchies of energies, which will lead to more fulfilling lives, a fact first pointed out in depth by the American psychologist Abraham Maslow and investigated and applied presently by cognitive therapists. In the next dimension, we simply find that people leading selfish lives gather in a corresponding environment which greatly limits their power, whereas people who lead altruistic lives enjoy the pleasurable emotions of love and caring and of positive, expansive, creative energies, will have greater power and a more agreeable environment on the next dimension. It is simply nature's law of like attracting like. In reality, death in itself does not have to be the dramatic downturn of events in one's life as it is painted from our mortal point of view. Except for a very few occasions, I have never experienced the same sense of drama as reported by people with near-death experiences. However, this may be due to the fact that I have learned to treat these events as a fairly natural process, which leads me to believe dying too can be a quite undramatic and natural process. We should not suffer the illusion that life will take a dramatic turn when shifting into another dimension. I can't imagine that there is a great difference between leaving one's body temporarily or permanently, except of course if it is brought about by trauma. For the average dying person, it will be no more dramatic than going to eye sleep, because very little will actually have changed when arriving on the other side. Many people will take some convincing that they are dead, as the first impression is that they feel just as alive as before. Even the environment will be the same. Gradually, though, nature's laws of attraction will kick in and connect us to our natural energy environment. This can mean that our environment changes into the proverbial heaven or hell. Or we can continue simply and gradually from where we left off via the gradual process of learning and advancement. See 2. Many of us who suffer depression may find ourselves in a bleak world. Fortunately, if our basic character is sound, and we generally operate on an altruistic energy level, we will find that we are much closer to turning our state of mind around than we would be able to on the gross physical earth. For a start, we would attract helpers and energies that would assist us the moment we opened our minds and hearts. This doesn't happen automatically, though. The mind must open first. There is little point in describing the afterlife. The afterlife of a rock star will be totally different from that of a nun or a racing driver, the same as their lives are here. All I can do is focus on the underlying reality and allow their reader to imagine what their own afterlife will be like once they take all their dreams, loves and likes into consideration. Next headline, the broad subdivisions. As we have established, it is not possible to give a comprehensive description of the higher dimension. What I've written is nothing more than travel journals like those written by any orthodox travel writer. The best that can be done is to describe certain universal laws which underpin the dimensions and allow the readers to use their imagination to paint their own picture. There is a consensus among mystics and occultists alike, who refer to these dimensions as the astral or mental planes, that the purpose of these are worlds is to express and fulfill desires and, as on earth, to provide a training grogram for self-development, and this is exactly what they do. Let us start with self-development. There can't be a better training ground for evolution than the lowest and most hellish of dimensions where the individual is faced with the shortcomings of his or her personality and experiences the dire consequences of their actions. If this type of learning system could be implemented on Earth, replacing traditional forms of incarceration and punishment, crime rates would drop dramatically, because the instant a crime was committed the perpetrator would experience the crime from his victim's viewpoint and suffer the same consequences. These are simply the ways in which nature works. Justice and punishment are not administered by a superior intelligence, they are simply the result of subtle energy balances. Even on the higher subdivision, learning, self-expression and evolution are the primal aspects of higher dimensional life. There are plenty of opportunities for further education once the novelty of pursuing one's dreams has worn off. But living and realizing one's dreams is, of course, one of the most important, and, to many, the most attractive function of the other dimensions. The desire for all the things we strive for in this life builds up powerful energies and the way nature has designed its releases by allowing us to express them to the full on the next dimension. To many of us living here on Earth, this would be a tottery win. Though this can mean different things to different people. I have seen people driving supercars, living in magnificent houses and having all the trappings a millionaire lifestyle has to offer. Although the expression of these desires is very much dependent on the level the individual has advanced to, there is simply not enough creative energy on the lower levels to allow these dreams to come to fruition, and a person will have to earn the power of realization by a process of moral and psychological purification. On top of that, the absence of aging, illness and decay, and all the things that are needed to maintain the functioning of the physical body, are tremendous added bonuses, as is the power to travel instantly to any place you wish. The more a person purifies their psychological makeup, harmonizing their nature, the more their life will become symmetrical and will allow for a greater flow of energy, which will in turn open their creative channels, and thereafter the power of creation increases proportionally. 8. These powers become ever more magnified on the higher dimensional levels, together with an increased level of awareness and an expanded consciousness. In fact, the person synchronizes with the universal energy and accesses the very matrix of creation. To give an example, I struggled when I was conjuring up wine in a supermarket 9 on the lower plane, and when I did the wine tasted poor, more like juice. On a much higher plane, people are able to control the environment, evoke natural phenomena and create incredible cities and miracles of art and science.